Hello and welcome to the Journey to the Heart podcast. My name is Torin Lokes. I'm a singer-songwriter from the Yukon Territory, Canada, and my current mission is to paddle a canoe across America from the Pacific to the Atlantic Ocean while learning more about what happiness, community, connection, self-empowerment, as well as finding and living your passions and dreams means to different people I meet along the way. So I have now completed my 400-mile bicycle portage through the Rockies, and despite a very old yet sturdy bike without a front derailleur, narrow, sometimes treacherous roads, and often steep, windy, and windy terrain, I had the pleasure of traversing through some incredible mountain passes, soaked in some beautiful hot springs, and met some inspiring people along the way. Upon reaching Helena, Montana, I was fortunate to be hosted by Jim and Vicky Emmanuel, who along with the incredible River Angels Tom and Sue Iyer from Lewiston helped bring my canoe right to the Missouri headwaters, where I met them on my bicycle before finally pushing my canoe into a downstream current. It's hard to put into words what it means to me after months of paddling and pedaling upstream to finally be paddling downstream towards the Gulf of Mexico. So much effort, mentally, emotionally, and physically, has gone into getting here over the last 4 months. And I've given up and gained so much in a process that has been truly transformational. I was also fortunate to have Jim and the Missouri River legend Norm Miller paddle with me for the first couple days from the headwaters. In this conversation, I sat down with Jim Emmanuel, who along with being a retired firefighter and hypnotist, paddled the Missouri River from source to sea in 2018, the year he turned 60. We talked about canoe expeditions, transformational journeys, the power of self-hypnosis, and how to move towards living a life that you love. I also wanted to give a shout out to the very first members that have joined my new Patreon community. I put a lot of love, time, and effort into these journeys, this podcast, my music, and my other creative projects, and I deeply appreciate the support in helping cover my costs and providing greater and continued opportunity to develop and share them with you all. If you enjoy what I'm doing and want to support this podcast and other projects that I'm working on, please consider joining my Patreon community, which you can find through my website at www.tornlokes.com. Hey, Jim.
Morning.
Morning. How are you?
Pretty good. A cup of coffee in the morning and a beautiful morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit more about yourself.
Oh, well, I'm retired now for 10 years. I was a professional firefighter in Southern California and retired and moved to, lucky enough to move to the middle of Montana and been here since the last 10 years.
So what is it about Montana that brought you here?
Oh, mostly the rivers and the mountains, the prairies and the open spaces, but mostly the rivers. I like the rivers.
You grew up paddling a lot?
Not paddling. I grew up boating in South Dakota. Mostly, we had a canoe and we canoed a little bit, but mostly fishing boats, and when I went to college, I had a summer job as a river guide for a whitewater rafting company in Colorado and Utah, and I did that for 5 summers. And since then, I became addicted to whitewater rafting, big long trips, anywhere from a week to 3 week trips.
Cool.
That's where we spent all our vacations. On the rivers in Idaho and Oregon and Utah, Colorado, Arizona, floating down rivers with myself. And started going with all these guys I used to work with as a guide. And since, they all kind of moved on to career jobs and got their own rafts. And we just started spending summers together on rivers.
So what is it about whitewater rafting that just really drew you to it?
Originally it was the whitewater, the thrill of the whitewater. And as the years went by, I liked just more of the, I don't mind running a flatwater river anymore. I mean, I like big whitewater. It's the thrill and it's exciting. And the one thing about running big whitewater is when you're in a rapid, whether it only takes 2 seconds or 20 seconds, it's about the only time in your life where you're thinking about is what's happening right now, this second. Your mind's not wandering anywhere, you know, but what you're doing right now, which is, I think that's why I like that. And then afterward, you come out and you float a few miles and your mind wanders wherever, you know, wherever it goes. And then you come up to a big rapid again and your concentration and focus is so intense about, you know, getting your right line and, you know, making some big moves in the water that you're living right at the moment, which is what I like about the whitewater. And then I just like the multi-day river trips. You kind of get in the flow. You forget about what's going on at home. You forget about your job, your mowing the lawn or whatever, you know.
Simplifies things.
Yeah, simplify your thinking, just what you're doing. So that's kind of what draw me to that.
Yeah.
Is that what you're doing right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I agree a lot with that. I think being brought into the present moment with being on the water, it's something that's really powerful, you know, because it has a way of soothing your worries about life and kind of reframing things as well. I think it has a way of refreshing and rejuvenating a person, where you come back from a trip like that and you're like, oh, what was that was bothering me?
Right.
Doesn't feel so bad now.
Right. And life is simple on the river. You know, it's just simple. You can't do anything but just where you are and you make it to the next camp or make lunch or dinner or try to fight the wind and make it to the next point. If you make it there, you might make it to another point. If you don't, you pull over and you don't have to go home and, like I said, mow the lawn or get in the morning and do it again.
It's true. It's like simple yet profound and in its simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've paddled the Missouri River from source to sea.
Well, not source. The ultimate source is Brower Spring, where it just bubbles out of the mountain up in the Centennial Mountains. And, I started at the headwaters.
Okay.
Yeah, where the Missouri Missouri forms by the Gallatin, the Jefferson, and the Madison. And that's probably 200 miles down from what is actually the source. But the source is tough. It's basically a hike. You can't float down a 2 CFS coming out of the mountain. And,
you need like a little like blow up raft or like a kayak or something.
When it comes out, I don't think I haven't been there, but it comes out, it gurgles out of the mountain. It's not even you could. I think it's probably about 2 inches wide, and it slowly builds as it gets down into the valleys. And when I did my trip in 2018, I originally was going to float down the, start at the Big Hole, and it was a big flood year, so I went up there and I was going to float about 100 miles down the Big Hole to the Jefferson and then on down. And
that's what I was thinking of doing as well.
Yeah.
A little late in the season though now.
Well, I had so much water, everything was flooded. And I was going to take my whitewater raft and do that first section because I wouldn't have done very well in the canoe. And I went up and there was like at least 3 bridges that I couldn't fit my boat under. And there were no eddies. So I would have been a runaway raft trying to, 2-foot-tall raft trying to go under, you know, 6 inches between the top of the water and the bottom of the bridge. It would have been, wasn't even an option. So I waited it out for a couple of weeks for water to go down, and it never did. And so finally I put on it at the headwaters of the Missouri and started there.
Well, it's a beautiful area.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, just a few days ago when we went up there, you know, I bicycled from your house 50 miles up there, and we tried to get to the Missouri River Headwaters Park, and then there's that bridge that was closed, and we put in a couple miles upstream on the Jefferson, and just, it's just so beautiful up there.
Yeah. That was a good call. Hitting that bridge was perfect.
Yeah, there's like the landing was just 100 yards down.
Yeah. And I had, you know, my goal is to get one new section of river every year. That's why I only got three miles of it, but it was a new section of river, and it was beautiful up there. I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, me too. And it's nice to have your little yellow lab pup, Steve, join us. He seems to be a good boating companion.
Yeah, he's pretty good. Catch him right on. He's pretty cool.
Yeah. So what was it that inspired you to paddle the whole Missouri River?
Well, you know, being a whitewater guy, my goal was always to, not my goal, but one of the trips I always wanted to do was follow John Wesley Paul's expedition from the headwaters or the Wind River Range in Wyoming, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, or the Gulf of California, sorry. And that would entail going down the Green River and into the Colorado River. And there's a lot of issues with that right now. There's three or four permitted sections there, and you have to get a permit, lucky enough to get a permit, or else get on a trip that someone invites you on that has a permit. And you'd have to link all these trips together. And you have to, when you have a permit, you have to start on that day. And you only get so many days to go through this section. Like the Grand Canyon, it's almost impossible to get a private permit. And you have now 16 days to get from to the Grand Canyon section. And just to say it, to tell someone, okay, I could be there July 20th when you're starting up in the Wind River Range is almost impossible.
Yeah.
So, but that's where I still would like to do that. And but I've been, since I moved here, I spend most of my time on the Missouri River. I've got various boats. And I would always, every year I'd see guys paddling across Canyon Ferry Lake with all this gear. And
yeah.
I'd talk to them and they'd tell me what they're doing. I go, oh, that's kind of cool. Never really thought much about myself doing it. I'm not a canoer. And then in the August of, I think it was August of 2017, I'm up on the river where you're going to probably paddle through today, up the delta where the river flows into Canyon Ferry. I like to fish there. And I'm anchored, and here comes this guy in a cedar stripper canoe. He had a big yellow Labrador that was swimming behind him. And he pulled in, and I was anchored, and he pulled grass on my boat, and we're talking, and his Labrador, we probably talked for an hour, and this Labrador treaded water in the current the whole time. It was kind of fun. And he was telling me about his trip, going down. He started at Twin Bridges on the Jefferson, and he was going to paddle to Fort Peck Dam. And so he was a week into the trip. He was so stoked about his trip, and I started asking him questions. And by the time we got done talking, I had already made up my mind that I'm going to paddle the Missouri to St. Louis, just kind of on a whim. And so I got home and decided I'm going to tell my wife I'm going to take next summer and paddle. I didn't know what kind of craft I was going to paddle. I wasn't a canoe. I thought, well, maybe I can get a drift boat because I like oars. And, so that was yet to be determined. Anyway, she said, yeah, you should do it. You just go do it. So I mean, it was that easy. And so in the winter, I finally come to the conclusion the canoe would be a lot more efficient than a dory or a drift boat. And so I got a canoe and wasn't very steady in it. And I had all winter to just look at it because, you know, it was ice here. And I got it out. And basically, I started to learn how to paddle when I put in that at the headwaters in a canoe.
Wow. Well, I've seen you paddle, you know, since then. And it seems like you got it. You got a pretty good stroke at this point.
Well, 3.5 million strokes down to the Gulf of Mexico, you learn it. I won't say I'm technically very good, but I can move the boat. That's about it, you know. I don't even know the names of the strokes. I just paddle.
You get a feel for it after thousands of miles.
Yeah.
So when you got down to the lake, I mean, the Missouri has these massive lakes.
Yes.
That come around. And,
yes.
And what was that experience like for you?
Well, you start with the smaller lakes. You know, the first lake you come to is Canyon Ferry. It's 25 miles long. And the next one is Hauser. And the next one after that is Holter. And I'm on those lakes all the time, so I know them really well. But I still had to paddle across them. And they're all paddleable in one day each.
Yeah.
But they can get big, especially Canyon Ferry. It can get really big really quick. But it's just
time.
Yeah, and it's just a little practice for when you get to the real lakes, starting at Fort Peck and then Sakakawe and then the Oahe is the one that really gave me a time.
Oahe, how long is Oahe?
I think it's about 240 miles or so.
Wow.
It basically starts at Bismarck and goes to Pier. You know, halfway across, it turns, you know, so the thing about Hawaii is that, you know, South Dakota's a windy. And when you get to Bismarck, that river turns south and you have a prevailing south wind. And, you know, Fort Peck is big and that can be really big and windy and dangerous. And same with the Sakakawea. But they have like some canyon walls, kind of like where Oahe is just a big open prairie lake, and it gets,
there's no protection.
It's huge, so you can't like cut corners from point to point. You gotta kind of stick on if you're smart, you kind of stick on the shoreline because the wind can come up out of nowhere, and you don't really want to be 3 miles out from shore.
Right, I can see it being tempting to want to, you know, straight line.
Yeah.
Certain aspects of that.
Yeah.
And just having to navigate the sort of windy shoreline.
Oh, you could go, I mean, if you follow the shoreline, especially on Peck, because Peck is like a big amoeba. It's got all these arms. I think it's got more shoreline than the west coast of the United States. So it would take you probably a year or more to follow the whole shoreline. So you have to cut from point to point.
Wow, so you're saying that lake near Fort Peck has more shoreline than the entire coast of the United States.
Right. Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think so. Dave Forbes has been spending the last 3 summers going along the shoreline to try to circumnavigate that whole lake. And he's doing that right now. In the summers, he's trying to get that done.
Jeez.
So what I would do is, I wouldn't go unless the wind was blowing in the right direction, and I would come up to a point and I look across and I might not go exactly point to point, but I'd try to pick a little bit of a compromise, and I'd pick that point. And once I start paddling, I just tell myself. So you get out in the middle and you might want to say, well, I'm out here, it's nice and calm, maybe I'll just fudge a little bit, you know what I mean, and go a little bit farther out than that point. But I just kept telling myself, and you might save a half mile. So I kept telling myself, okay, go straight across, don't mess around. No matter, and I keep telling myself, okay, don't mess around, go straight across. And you get to you get across and you go, ooh, made it.
You paddle along the shore.
Yeah, then kind of go out to the next point and then go across. And because they have these little microbursts out there, and you can be dead flat, and in 30 seconds you have a 40 mile an hour wind just coming out of nowhere. And if you're out in the middle, you're not in a good spot.
Well, heck, when we were paddling from the headwaters, right. that happened to us.
Right.
And that's when the river is, like, you know, pretty narrow. And coming around that corner from the Tostin Dam, those winds were probably like 60 miles an hour.
Yes.
And we couldn't, it was almost like a force field. Like, we couldn't paddle more than 100 yards in like 20 minutes.
Oh, we paddled, we did about a mile and a half. It took us 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's that's a 5-minute float on a calm day. Yeah, it was crazy.
Well, you know, Jim, it's interesting just how every river system really is like its own world. You know, because coming over from the Columbia and the Snake is like, it's just very different challenges.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the Columbia is a powerful river. It has all these different challenges and dangers and also, you know, incredible beauty. And now it really feels like I've entered the Missouri River system and I almost have to learn a new language. Like, there's a certain amount of skills that translate over, but then as you're talking to me about the Missouri River and what's to come, it's like, wow, I'm amazed at just how much more there is to learn depending on the river.
Well, the thing about the Missouri is, you know, you have 1,000 miles of reservoir, but you start off small on these smaller lakes, relatively smaller lakes, and that's a great learning experience from when you hit Peck, and then Sakakawea, and then the big one. When I got to the dam at Oahe, I was like, that's like a milestone.
Oh, I bet. Because then you start getting some current again?
Not really. You get current for like 5 miles down to pier. And then you have like sharp. But you can get across like sharp in 2 days, 2 or 3 days. It's not this big monster lake. And then you have Francis Case, which is a real, you know, it's a big lake. It's, I don't know, 30... No, it's about 50 miles long. I don't know exactly that. And then Lewis and Clark. So they get small. They're still big, but they're not Oahe or Sakakawea or Peck.
Yeah.
And so.
And what were some of the other challenges that you experienced on your journey? Because how long did it take you to paddle to the Gulf of Mexico?
120 days.
120 days.
Yeah.
And Yeah, like what were some of the other things that...
Well, the weather.
Yeah.
I mean, the weather dictates everything. You know, especially on those big reservoirs. And especially in June and July in the Dakotas when, you know, the storm season. The weather rules.
Yeah.
And a canoe, it's the deciding factor in everything you do.
Were there like some like tornado storms and?
Yeah, I had went through. I never actually saw a tornado because most of the storms I hit were at night. I had at least 3 storms with 80-mile-plus winds, and one storm had clocked at 105-mile-per-hour gusts. It wasn't sustained, but I wrecked a tent. I remember sitting in my tent one night. Well, these were like 3 out of 5 days in a row that I had these storms. It's kind of like a storm cycle. And I remember sitting in my tent, and the whole sky was vibrating, and it's like you were in a disco with the strobes going and lightning and thunder, and this roar like a freight train coming down.
Yeah.
And just a deafening roar. It sounded just like a freight train. And my tent's flat. I'm pinned in my tent. I got my life jacket on, my transponder on my life jacket. Thinking, well, and I had 24 stakes on my tent because I saw it on my weather tracker that storm was coming. Excuse me. So I staked out, and these were big military surplus stakes, the V-shaped ones. And I brought a big mallet and a lot of stakes and a lot of rope, and so my tent wasn't going to fly away, but it could have got just ripped away. So my advice, I see these guys coming through and they got a little, and I was a four season tent, it was bomber, and it still bent all my poles. But my advice is get real stakes and a lot of them, and those little backpacking, you know, titanium stakes, leave those at home.
Well, it's funny, it's something I've done for a number of years now is I'll go to Home Hardware and get like the big nails.
Yeah.
You know, the 8-inch, 10-inch nails. And even those are a hell of a lot better than some of those little dinky plastic stakes that you see that come with some of these tents.
Right.
It's interesting, though, when you're talking about that disco lightning just having that kind of heavy storm, because the first time I experienced that was about 10 miles from where you grew up.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Milbank, South Dakota.
Right.
I had bicycled from Milbank, South Dakota to Ortonville, Minnesota, and set up my tent in the city park there, and then got hit by a storm pretty similar to the one you just described.
Yes. The Midwest out there, their summer storms are pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, it gives you a different level of respect for the power of nature. And so what were some of the things that you really gained from your journey, or that just really amazed you or surprised you?
Oh, just, well, the power of the nature. And then also one thing I didn't expect or even anticipate or even think about was all the friendships I gained going downriver. I set out to be totally self-sufficient. You know, I wasn't going to walk around the dams. I was going to hitchhike or get a ride. And I didn't really want any help from any so-called river angels. So I didn't make a list of people that I should go see. But I did have a tracker, and I was on Norm's Facebook site. So people would actually track me down and find me, you know, because I wasn't hiding. I was on a tracker, pinged every 5 minutes. So if they wanted to find me, they could. And I had people come up that I hadn't seen since high school or before and find me. And that was pretty cool. And they drive, a couple of them would drive 200 miles to go take me out for lunch. And I also met all these new friends that I had never met before. They, you know, take me in, and do my laundry, give me a place to stay, feed me dinner. And that was really unexpected and really probably the best part of the trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's that reciprocity of just having people open up their home to you and connect in that way. I think it's just an amazing way to build friendships with people.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think gets overlooked a lot, you know, in our current society where things can become so transactional and, you know, it becomes about just like, you know, it's like pay to get this work done or to do this or get a ride to here. But then when somebody just comes through for you like that in an unexpected way, all of a sudden you might have a lifelong friendship where you can be like, hey, let's meet up and paddle this river in the future. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you come up to Canada, you know, now you have a place to stay and have a place to can share my world with you. And is that, and so when you were going down the river, were you finding that just continued all the way down to the Gulf?
Oh yeah. Even more so. Up in Montana, and you know, I had very few interactions with people because it's so remote. And then I got to North Dakota, and I, you know, in South Dakota, I met a couple people that I had known, and they were actually have a cabin down in Fort Peck Lake, and they brought a package I had already given them, and they delivered it, and so that was that, And then, you know, Peggy at Tobacco Gardens is the first, and she's strategically placed where it's a perfect spot, because you've been on the river for a month. already, and you need laundry done, and something real to eat, and maybe an air-conditioned cabin. She's got all that. And she's and then from there on down, there are more. I'm not going to go through all the names because I'm going to forget somebody. But the farther down you get, the more established these river angels are, and so from there on down, you have help and friendships. And when you get down to Missouri, there's a bunch of them. And they expect you to come in, and they treat you like royalty. It makes some very good friendships along the way.
Special. Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you get that contrast, you know, like even how you reached out to me when I was bicycling over the Rockies, and then pulling up to your house, I got to say, like, I was pretty exhausted.
Yes, you were.
Riding this old bike from the 1970s, you know, changing gears with a stick. Once again, you know, because I did that in a previous trip with my dad's old bike, and then, like, I gotta say, like, having been able to come here and meet you guys, it has just been so rejuvenating, and it was really special to have you and Norm Miller, who has been such a spirit animal of the Missouri River with helping all the paddlers, and having both of you join me while I paddling from the headwaters for the first couple days was really special.
Yeah, that was fun. And the Norm, they call him the source. Yeah, he's a factor in everything that goes on the Missouri River. He's a wealth of information, a great guy to paddle with, and you know he knows every paddler that comes through. He knows every paddler that's come through for the last 100 years.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only a day and a half down from the headwaters, so I offer my help to people, but they, you know, who needs help when the first day you start your trip? So, but you know, you've been paddling a different trip, so.
Yeah, it's been some complications, to say the least.
Yeah.
I mean, those first 2 days were awesome, and then, you know, it was unfortunate that we had that crazy wind and then pulled our boats out, and then a mile from your place, that canoe, my canoe, flew off the roof and
yes,
and
destroyed it.
Got destroyed. It was kind of a freak accident, but you know, it's interesting how when things like that happen, things have a way of working out, and mm-hmm. and I'm just really glad that it sounds as though there's going to be a craftsman that will be able to fix it over the winter. And I'm going to have to rename my boat the Phoenix now.
Right. Oh, it'll make it down. They glue it back together.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the nature of these journeys, though. There's always going to be some curveballs.
Oh, yes.
Whether it's your tent being destroyed or my canoe flying off the roof of the car, or, you know, I think that one thing you learn through like these long expeditions is that it could always be worse. And so you kind of almost learn to appreciate the adversity in that, you know, I'm just grateful like the canoe didn't hit a car behind us or destroy your truck or hurt us. You know, the fact that it was just the boat pretty much, it's like, well, it's repairable. So now it adds to the story.
Right. That's a minor detail, just a direct boat. It's not like anybody got hurt.
Yeah. Well, it's special to like have it be fixed as well. And then it'll be nice to be like, you know, it'll add to the story of the boat when I finally get down to the Gulf next summer. And
exactly.
Yeah. It is special to me that my dad actually helped in the designing of that boat. As well, mm-hmm. like he was telling me that, because my dad had an adventure guide company, and the Mad River guys were paddling up on the Wind River in the Peel watershed, and you know, they were kind of passing each other up there, and then they camped together and were talking about designs and everything, and you know, my dad had his, he spent like a couple decades guiding up there. And so they were going over designs, and he helped them with some of the ideas for that specific Revelation design. And then I found this all out after, you know, getting in touch with these guys down in Bellingham who, through Facebook Marketplace, and they just happened to have this Mad River canoe, which is now discontinued. So it was really special that since I grew up paddling, you know, that boat, at home, and, to be able to take that, you know, from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic, or, to the Gulf of Mexico is pretty neat. So I was like a little devastated when it first broke, 'cause I'm like, oh no. But then as soon as I found out it could be fixed, then it was like, okay, good.
Yeah, it's just a little glitch.
Yeah, these things happen. But I'm grateful that I'll be able to, you know, borrow your boat for at least this next section and just kind of get my feet wet, so to speak, paddling down to Fort Benton. That Missouri River break section sounds like it's sort of like the first real test of remoteness and on the Missouri.
Yeah. I mean, it's remote, but there are other paddlers there.
Yeah.
So you will see people. Depending on the time of year, when I paddled through there, it was 1st of June, and it was really high water. And I only saw one other boat the whole trip through the breaks, which I think was really probably not very common. There's several thousand people paddle it. But where you're going to get really remote is between the end of the break section, which is at James Kipp Campground, to like UL Bend on the, which is a big bend on the top of Fort Peck Lake. You won't see anybody there.
Yeah.
That'll be 3 or 4 days of the most remote spot that you'll go through on that whole trip.
So when you got down to the Mississippi and you were starting to get close to the Gulf, what was going through your mind and what was that feeling like?
Oh, just, I mean, it was kind of my, actually it was not my goal to get to the Gulf. I started the trip just going to St. Louis, and then I met four other, two groups of two paddlers. Gary and Linda DeCoke, which I paddled with for a few days. I met them up on Lake Oahe. And then also Martin Trahan and Jill Brown. And they had, and we paddled together for a few days, and then we kind of went our own ways. And then I met up with Jill and Martin again in Kansas City. And but when I got about 2 days above St. Louis, I said, well, I'm just going to go all the way to the Gulf. It's only another month, and because I really didn't want the trip to end. And so I kept going and traveled with Martin and Jill. And then Martin and Jill split up, and then I just traveled with Martin. And we picked up a couple other paddlers on the way. And so when I got to the Gulf, I really didn't want it to end either, but I had commitments, and that was the end of my trip.
Yeah, and you said it, you told me before that paddling into the Gulf was kind of an overwhelming feeling.
Oh, it was. It was just, I can't really explain it. All of a sudden, it was like your end goal, and all of a sudden, your trip is over, you're elated, and your trip is over, and you're bummed out, and your trip is over, and you accomplished this pretty good paddle, and it's all this sensory overload, very emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that when I paddled the Mississippi from source to sea, and I feel like it's going to be like that on steroids when I finish this journey.
Well, it's a longer trip. You know, it's 1,000 miles longer.
Yeah.
And, not that that has anything to do with it, but, well, your trip is more than 1,000 miles longer.
Yeah, it's going to be, oh man, I don't even know. I think it's, I don't know the full mileage. I just know that just what I've already gone through to get here has just been undescribable.
Yeah, that was the hard part. Now you're just going downhill.
I don't know. It sounded like there's some challenges coming up. But
You're not going up. You're not paddling against the current anymore.
Well, that'll be nice.
Yes.
That would be very nice. And, you know, it was pretty fun that first day when we were able to... You have a sail for your canoe as well. And when we both had those...
Oh, that was incredible. Yeah.
And then just a screaming tailwind and left poor Norm in the dust.
Yeah, that was the fastest I've ever gone in a canoe.
Yeah, that was the moment where you have a nice downstream flow. You get the sail up and paddling. And all of a sudden, and we're probably going like 15 miles an hour.
Yeah, all the conditions will probably never happen again.
Yeah, yeah. Hold on to that memory.
Yeah.
And so you, just to rewind a bit, you were a firefighter for how long?
Oh, yeah, I was a paramedic firefighter for 30 years.
Yeah. And what was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was the greatest job ever. Awesome job. I liked it. And then, you know, you get so... It's a tough job on your body and getting waked up every... You know, we work 24-hour shifts and getting up 3 or 4 times a night. When you get to be in your 50s, it's hard on you.
Because you celebrated your 60th birthday while paddling down the Missouri.
Right. Yeah.
That's pretty special.
Yeah, it was cool.
And yeah.
I went by the mouth of the Marias on my 60th birthday.
Yeah. Well, that's a transformational experience to sort of do something of that magnitude and also to develop a new passion for canoeing, you know. That must have been pretty cool to bring that back with you now that you're done.
Yeah. And I canoe now more. My raft, my whitewater raft, sits in the garage more than it should because it's just easier to grab a canoe and go out.
Well, you've got a beautiful boat too, that little Winona.
Yes, that's a great little boat.
It's like when we switched on the river, I was just like...
You're in a Maserati now.
I know. I was using your carbon fiber paddle. That's the first time I've ever used a carbon fiber paddle. And it literally felt like I was holding like a thought. Like it was a piece of air.
It is. Yeah. 8 ounces.
Yeah.
The only thing is you can't set me. It down.
I wish I'd never touched that paddle. Because now I pick up my old aluminum one and it feels like I'm using a baseball bat.
Right. Yeah. You can never drop your carbon fiber paddle or it'll blow away like a paper plate.
I bet once you get down to those big lakes.
Yeah.
And so you're a firefighter for many decades and I think it's interesting, you know, I think there's a big difference when you're doing something that you love for that long. You know, it sounded like you developed a lot of really great friendships through that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Like
a lot of great guys that I worked with, very competent guys, you know.
Yeah.
We were a busy department, and those guys are very good at what they do, you know. I get in a wreck or I need a medical aid or a fire, and the guys I work with would show up at my house, I'd be in good hands.
I think there's something to be said for when you go through adversity with people and overcome those kind of challenges, it really just creates another bond, like another level of trust.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And you also learned how to be a hypnotist through someone you met through work, or your friend.
Yeah, one of the guys I worked with, he was a hypnotist, and he taught me, you know, our downtime at work, he taught me hypnosis, and I took a liking to it, and I was pretty good at it, you know, and he used it at work. I remember seeing him, we had this young person that had a broken arm, and we were on the ambulance together those days. And we had to get on the radio to the hospital and ask for an order for morphine to help this kid's pain. And while I'm on the radio asking the nurse to, you know, if we can give morphine to this kid, he hypnotized this kid and told him that his arm doesn't hurt anymore and he's pain free. Wow, that's the first time I saw him hypnotize people. And so he taught me how to do it. And then we also messed around with hypnosis at work. He'd hypnotize people and have them do skits and stuff. And I got into it to help my kids with their mental status, and especially in sports. It's great for that. And he taught me, you know, over the years, he would teach me things. And then I started doing stage shows because people wanted a hypnotist. And then I learned how to do a stage show. I set up a program and kind of took off from there. So I started doing grad nights and proms and a lot of high school stuff. And then some nightclubs. And I'm kind of out of it now because I just kind of didn't lose interest, but just other things to do.
Yeah, you've been paddling a lot.
Yeah.
So what exactly is hypnotism and what is that experience like? Like how do you do that?
Hypnosis is a bit hard to explain because no one really knows how it works. Even psychiatrists don't know how it works. But it's pretty fascinating. It kind of, when I hypnotize somebody, I'm talking them through self-hypnosis. So you're hypnotizing yourself. And if you're open and willing to let that happen, I can talk you through a meditation type thing, and you can actually become hypnotized. You're self-hypnotized. I don't have control over a person, but I can give them suggestions on to help them. Or do a skit, or think that they're a giraffe, or help them with smoking, or not smoking. Or it's a bit complicated, and I don't even understand it, how it works. But it does work, and it's real. And that's just about all I can say about that.
So when you've been hypnotized. You've been hypnotized as well, and so yes. You know what that feels like.
Yes.
And how would you describe that feeling?
It's like a meditative feeling. It's very relaxing. And people that are hypnotized are open for it because it is, it's like a yoga. It's almost like a yoga or meditation. And, you know, basically for every 15 minutes you're hypnotized, it's like you're getting a 4-hour power nap. Even though you're not asleep, your mind is hyper alert. You're getting a power nap, and people thrive on that. They get hypnotized and they go, sure, I love it. I do it. I've been hypnotized before. I'd love it. I'll hypnotize me. Wow. And they wake up and they feel, I haven't felt this good in a long time.
So it's almost like a part of yourself is asleep and another part of yourself is like really awake.
Yeah, kind of. Your body's very relaxed. You can tell when somebody's hypnotized. I can spot a hypnotized person, and I can tell when they're going to go out. And, their blood kind of drains. They get pale, and they get cool. Their body's slot. You're not holding it. Everything just kind of relaxes. All your muscles relax. And even your head. You can't hold your head up. But your mind is going. It's just open.
Wow. Yeah. And so what are some of the like meaningful hypnoses that you've done or you've seen or you've helped people with hypnosis?
Oh, I've done a lot with people that want to eat better or quit smoking or quit drinking. And every hypnotist has a different way of dealing with that. You know, some people say you open the refrigerator and there's a piece of cake in there. And you take a piece of that cake and it tastes like tar. So it tastes terrible, you're never going to do it. Where I found that I use a more positive reinforcement. I said, you open the refrigerator and that piece of cake is there, but for some reason you don't really don't want it, but you see that carrot sitting right next to it and you eat that carrot and it tastes wonderful. And every time you eat a carrot, you can feel your body getting more healthy and rejuvenated, and it seems to work better than a negative reinforcement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
And the same thing with smoking, you know, a lot of hypnotists, and it's not wrong, hypnotists say, yeah, you taste that cigarette and it tastes like you're smoking battery acid. It tastes terrible. And I'll give them the suggestion, and hypnosis is just the power of suggestion. That's all it is. You're suggesting things. And I'll say, hey, you've got a pack of cigarettes, but you realize that every time you don't smoke that cigarette, you can feel all that clean air coming in your body, and every time you breathe that air out, it's blowing all those toxins out. And that seems to work better than smoking battery acid. Sucking clean air, not battery acid. So that's my philosophy on that kind of hypnosis.
Yeah. And so you say with sports, like, you think that there's a lot of high-level athletes that use hypnosis?
Oh, absolutely, yes. A lot of top athletes have a hypnotherapist. If not that, they know how to hypnotize themselves into a positive thinking.
Yeah.
So you watch, like, the Olympics, and you watch... say a pole vaulter at the end of the runway, and they'll sit there with their eyes closed, and they're contemplating every step. They're contemplating that pole plant in the box, you know, how their hands are working, how their arms are working, where they're looking, and they're going through that whole vault in their mind before they even take that first step down the runway. And that's all, that is a form of hypnosis. They're imagining every step. And a golfer, you'll see them, they'll look at that putt and then they just stand there and they watch that ball roll into the hole before they even hit the ball. And that's a form of self-hypnosis.
Interesting. And so what kind of hypnosis have you done with sports for people?
Well, mostly with my kids. They're baseball and softball players, and I have them imagine the pitcher releasing the ball, and the ball, as it gets closer, it gets slower and bigger, and you can see the revolution, you can see the laces, and by the time it gets to the ball plate, it's standing still and they're hitting a beach ball. And so they walk up, and you'll see the kids, they'll walk up and they'll sit there and they'll close their eyes and they'll imagine that. And then they're ready to hit the ball. You know, pitch comes in. And, it's not actually truly happening, of course, but in their mind, it's all vision and watching that. And of course, with muscle memory and stuff.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Yeah, because I guess you've done a lot of shows and you're using this power of suggestion on people. And I guess you can see who is really resonating with it and kind of weed out the folks that their mind is kind of not letting them go through that experience.
And so if I do a show, a stage show, I don't go out and pick volunteers. I ask volunteers to come up. So here's what we're going to do. I'm not going to be in control of you. I'm not going to have you do anything that I wouldn't do. And so I gain some trust. And so I gave them a little talk, and they come up, they volunteer. And some of them, as they're walking up on stage, I can shake their hand and give them a handshake and put them out right. And they just go to the floor before they even get on the stage.
Wow.
And because they want it to happen. They're coming up, they're volunteering, they want this to happen, and their mind's open. And if I pick a person on the stage and he doesn't want to get hypnotized, it's not going to happen, because he or she does not want it to happen. And like I said, I'm not going to hypnotize you. I'm talking through self-hypnosis. And
yeah.
So that's how that works.
And so what are some of the wild things that you've seen through hypnotizing people and, you know, with shows and...
Oh, it's just everybody has a different mind and everybody interprets things differently. You know, if I tell someone that they are an ostrich and they're in a desert and there's 10 people up there doing it, I'm going to get 10 different responses. That's what's fascinating about it. Yeah. So when I do a show, I don't do a show where I bring people out and tell them they're all gorillas and they're going to run around the stage like a gorilla and they're all kind of doing the same thing. I like to have them use their imagination. And so I'll suggest that, say, you're sitting at a beach and you're watching out and you see this blue sky and the blue ocean and the surfers out there. All of a sudden you see Jaws, the shark, coming in. And I'll play Jaws music. And so there's 10 people and you get 10 different reactions. Some people are just, they just freeze in fright. And some people will hop in a skiff and paddle out there like a madman and throw a harpoon at it. All in the, you know, physically, you'll see them lift the harpoon and stab this thing. And so I like to let them use their imagination rather than just tell them that they're a tree. And there's, I do that too, but toward the end of the shows, I'm interested in seeing how their thought process goes.
Yeah, that must be pretty fascinating for you as a hypnotist, watching how people react in such different ways.
Yeah. It's amazing. And another thing I used to do is I'll take a roll of toilet paper and I'll say, these are $20 bills that I make in my garage. I got a roll of $20 bills and hand it to the person, take one down and pass it down the line. Some will take one, they'll look at it, some will take a piece, they'll carefully tear a piece out, fold up, put it in their pocket. The next one will do the same. Next one might tear a piece off and give it to the next person. And you get down there, and somewhere along the line, someone's going to take that roll and just start unrolling it, stuffing it in their pockets. They'll look around, make sure no one's looking at them. And that's interesting.
You were telling me about this Martian one that you do.
Yeah, that's a skit that I like to do.
Yeah, and what does that entail?
Well, I'll typically take three subjects and tell one person that he is come from Mars, been traveling for millions of light years or whatever, and he lands in whatever town I'm doing the show at, and he just happened to land there. And the next person would be a news reporter, with a TV news reporter. And luckily, she's been taking the only person on Earth that speaks Martianese. And, I mean, what luck is that? And breaking news, you know, breaking news, headline news. And then they'll usually have another person that's doing sign language for the hearing impaired. And it's fascinating to watch these people speak in Martian to each other, then translate to the news camera, and I mean, who knows what they're talking about, whether they can understand each other, but it's pretty fascinating what they come up with, why these Martians have come to Earth to visit Earth, and what they're here for. Some are here to start a war, some are here as friendly travelers, some are here, we had one that was here to harvest pigs. They wanted to kill wild boars. Of course, the news reporter was just in awe that that's the only reason he'd come here, is to kill wild boars. And but they're all different. I mean, I have no idea what they're gonna come up with.
Wow,
that's one of my favorite things to see.
Yeah, the amount of imagination that,
yes,
I mean, you as suggesting these things and then seeing them with yeah. their own unique personalities and experiences and ideas,
yes,
coming forward.
And on that particular skit, I don't suggest anything except that this Martian showed up on Earth for an unknown reason. I'll let them wing it from there.
Sounds absolutely yeah, hilarious.
That's really fascinating.
And what do you think is one of the more powerful hypnosis practices like that, you know, you could do just to improve people's lives? Like you talked about, you know, helping people with food and sports and lifestyle. But is there like some positive mentality ones?
Well,
that
for sure.
You do?
And like I said, I'm not hypnotizing. I'm just talking through self-hypnosis. And people who meditate do the same thing. You hypnotize yourself every day. If you're driving down the road, and how many times do you drive down the road and you've gone 10 miles and you have no idea how you got there without running off the road? Your mind's in another state. That's self-hypnosis. If you're reading a book and you're so absorbed in this good chapter that everything's blocked out, that's self-hypnosis.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's magic. We all do it all day long.
Yeah, interesting. And so to take that to, you know, self-improvement or trying to help make your life better.
Yeah, and yeah. The thing about going to a hypnotherapist is it's like you can get a program on the computer now, like one of those spinning wheels, and watch that and put yourself out and get a 15-minute rest. But there's that self-preservation mode that you're always thinking about. What happens if the doorbell rings or the fire alarm rings or I fall off my chair while I'm sitting here? The beauty of a hypnotherapist is you trusting yourself for him to watch over you, to hypnotize you and kind of be in control so you can actually go deeper down into hypnosis.
So there's levels to it.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, anywhere from barely being hypnotized to very deep.
So do people not remember sometimes when they...
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
Before the show's over, I said, okay, when we come out of this show, you're going to remember everything that you did. You were the star of the show. We did nothing to embarrass you. And usually I'll give them a positive thing. You know, from now on, you are going to, when it comes time to sleep, when your head hits the pillow, it's time to sleep. All your worries from the day will be gone. You're going to realize that all your friends, your school teachers, your best friends, your worst friends, are all, you're going to recognize them and tell them what you think that, what they mean to you in your life, and kind of give them a positive, you know, going away.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's always nice.
And that stays with them for a while.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And so then I also give them a suggestion. Anytime you want to go through this, as it learns, hypnosis is a learned progression. The more you do it, the more you accept it, and the better you become at it. And so I just tell them, you know, whenever they have a problem, there's different ways of doing it, just like there's 100 different ways of putting someone in hypnosis. I'll say, if you got a problem and you want to figure it out, just take your thumb and middle finger and press on it and focus on nothing but that, and just put yourself out for 10 minutes and those problems that you're having right now, you'll realize how minuscule they really are. And the more they do that, the more they get better at it.
That's just fascinating to me. And it makes you wonder what aspect of our humanity, you know, allows for us to go into that state. And, yeah. You know, how did we evolve to develop a mechanism like that? And clearly it's very powerful because it taps into your imagination.
Yes.
and your ability to also change reality, like your reality and the way you feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's going back to that question. People do remember. And because otherwise, I could also say, hey, you're not going to remember a thing about this hypnosis show you did. But what fun is that for the person that, I mean, the people in the audience had fun. But what fun is that for the person that is hypnotized? He doesn't remember doing any of it. All he remembers is, you know, he goes back onto the, back to his chair, and people tell him all the stuff he did. And he goes, oh, well, okay, but it would have been nice if I remembered doing it.
So you can suggest for people to remember everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you were also saying, like, even with cards, you can get people to remember the back of a card.
Oh, and not only that, some people can remember phone books. Give them a phone book to remember a page in a phone book, and they'll say, what is Terry Smith's number? And be able to recite it.
Wow. I wonder if that's like the power of the subconscious mind.
Oh, exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Subconscious mind.
Like letting that have more sway over what it is that you can do or think, you know, about.
So, and a lot of people are better at it than others. Some people can't remember, but some people can remember a whole page in a phone book.
Wow. What are some of the other kind of remarkable, almost superpowers that you've seen people do?
The one that I cannot figure out is, I like to do this card thing where I'll take a card out, or I'll fan a deck of cards out, and have a person pull a card out and memorize the back side of the card, not the face card, but the back side. And they'll study something. You can see their focus is so intense. That's all they're thinking about. And sometimes it takes a minute, sometimes it takes 10 minutes. They memorize this card, and I can put it back in the deck, and they'll pull that card out. And so they'll show me or the audience the face card before we put it back, so everybody knows what it is. And they'll go through the whole deck one at a time. Sometimes they go through it two or three times to find that. And then they'll start putting a pile. These are maybes. These are definitely outs. And they go, and then by the time, and they may go through the maybes twice, and they pick that card up. And I had one gal go through this, and she was a very good subject. She'd come down to these cards, and she'd have all these cards and go, well, I'm sorry, I can't find the card. But I know what it was. It was a Jack of Hearts. And I still can't figure this out. She goes, how do you know that? And it was the Jack of Hearts. So we do it 10 times. It was the Ace of Spades. She could do it every time. And she says, I couldn't see the card. I couldn't see what it was, but I could see that Ace of Spades burning a hole in the corner of the back side of the card.
Weird. So she was looking at the back side of the card, but somehow she always knew.
She knew what the front side was.
Yes. Wow.
And I have no idea. It's the only time I've seen that happen. And I was fascinated by it. We were on a raft trip.
Yeah.
Like a 5 or 10 day raft trip, I don't remember. We hypnotized her every day, and she did it every single time. You need to go to Vegas.
Wow. So would it be like the same card, or was she
totally different cards
every single time?
Yeah.
And she always
whatever card she picked out, just when you get one or 52 chances.
Like she'd shuffle it, she'd pick out a card,
yeah,
and then somehow just looking at the back side, she'd be able to know the front side of the card.
I said, how do you know that? And she said, I could see that 8 of diamonds burning a hole in the corner of the card. It's like, that's all. Yeah.
Wow. That's the power of the mind.
Yeah.
Have you seen people move in ways that were unexpected? Like do things like acrobatically or?
Oh, gosh. The first show I ever did, I had this, my brother called me, and I was just practicing hypnosis. I had no shows worked out. And he called and said his daughter was, graduated from high school, and they want to do an after graduation party. So I worked up a show, you know, kind of schematic. And toward the end of the show, I said, hey, does anybody have any special skills they could show us? And this was in Colorado. And this young kid says, I can snowboard. Well, I said, okay, let's see a snowboard across the stage. You know, there was no snowboard. And he starts kind of moving around, and then he runs, and there's, you know, they're all sitting in folding chairs. He was sitting on them. His folding chair is empty. He runs up and steps on the chair and does a full back, full gainer backflip and just sticks this landing.
Whoa, like off the chair.
Off the chair. And of course, this chair is up on about a 2-foot-tall stage. The chair goes flying, and my heart stops. This kid's going to end up, you know, in midair. Not my first show, and I got a broken neck. This kid just sticks it.
Whoa.
And and so after the show, you know, everybody in the whole heart just stops. We're going to have a huge injury here.
Yeah.
And so after the show, we're talking to this kid. He says, oh, I can do a full gainer on the slope on my snowboard. I've never tried it on land before.
Whoa.
And I learned a lot on that show. I got to be careful what I ask physically people to do, you know. So.
Wow.
I learned a lot, and I never did that kind of thing again.
That's incredible. So just being able to use self-hypnosis for people to open up abilities that they didn't even know they had.
Yeah.
Incredible. So what is it, what are some things, Jim, that you would, you've had a very interesting life, you've done a lot of different things, and what are some things that you would suggest for, like, a younger you or a younger person who's trying to live their dreams and do things that allow them to sort of pursue a life that makes them happy?
Just do things. You know, don't always put things off for tomorrow. You know, do it today. Yeah. Tomorrow might not be here. Don't find an excuse don't find an excuse to put things off. Just go out and do it. You know, there's always an excuse. I can't do it because I got to get my, you know, whatever. I got to get my oil changed in my car tomorrow. I can't go today. Well, put that off for a few days and just go do it.
I resonate a lot with that. I think you're right. We can push things forward so far that it ends
never
up
do it.
That you never do it.
Right.
And being able to break that spell.
Yeah, and do things that are, I mean, everybody's different. Some people don't like that kind of stuff, but, you know, people ask me why I did this trip. Isn't it hard? I go, yeah, it was hard. But if it was easy, what would be the point, you know?
And
a lot of stuff I do the hard way. You know, I hunt the hard way.
You're a bow hunter.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm a bow hunter, and I shoot a traditional bow that I made. I don't get a lot of harvest with it, but I like doing it. It's because it's hard.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think most things that are worthwhile, and it takes time. Like you have to put an effort to build it and grow it.
Yeah,
and I think that there's this idea that, you know, life is, the good things in life are going to be easy, but it actually seems to be kind of the opposite. I mean, I think when you initially discover something, there's an element to it where it's like, oh, it's easy, this is incredible. But then to go from that point and to continue to build it and to, it's going to take effort and creativity and growth.
Yeah, exactly right. Do it today. That's my, you know. Of course, you can't do it today, but if you're going to go a trip like that, it takes some planning.
Yeah.
But
don't let the planning take over to a point where you don't end up.
Right.
Finally taking that leap.
Right. And on a river trip, if you plan too much and things don't go exactly as you planned, some people can't handle that. It's just, everything's not set perfectly done. Chronological order, and as soon as you push off the river, you're on river time. If things don't go as planned and you're not ready for that, people have a hard time with that. But if you just kind of get that, well, okay, here's today, tomorrow's another day, it seems to work better for that kind of trip. As you know, you can't plan 10 minutes, you know, much less 10 days ahead.
Right. So it's like having that larger goal, but the way that you get there, realize that there's like infinite variations.
Yes. Yeah. A goal for the day, maybe, or a goal for the next hour, maybe. But yeah.
And do you feel, how do you feel different after, you know, you paddled the Missouri River from the headwaters to the Gulf, and do you feel like you're in a different space now than when you were before?
Oh yeah, you'd have to. If that doesn't change you, then you know nothing will. I'd say I don't know, it's hard to explain. A lot of people that would do that have a hard time adjusting back into the mainstream, I guess you'd call it. It takes a long time when you're done, it'll take you a long time to get back into the mainstream. You never really will, because and you can tell people about your trip that you've done, but unless they've done it, they're not going to understand even a fraction of what you're telling them, you know, just because it's not the way they're wired.
Yeah, or they, I feel as though some people, they resonate with it, like they either it's something that they have a calling for and want to do, or they've done some journey or something equivalent that resonates that part of who they are. But then there's also some people where you talk to them about these kind of journeys and it's almost like it's like speaking a different language.
Right.
It just goes right over their head.
Yeah, there's only a fraction of the population that even want to do a trip like that. It's just we're all different. You know, 99.9% of the population, they wouldn't want to do that trip. For whatever reason.
Well, I think there's like, and I think it's interesting because it, in some ways, like everybody has some calling or dream, you know,
for sure.
Dreams that speak to
different.
Them.
Yeah.
And that's where it's, that's what fascinates me, is that it's like, that's the commonality, is that, you know, people have, I think a lot of people have that voice within them of self-actualization and doing something difficult that's meaningful to them that they've always wanted to do. But it's like this mountain that you have to climb to do it. And it's daunting, and you can put it off. But going through that process, you know, step by step, it does change you. You know, and
oh, it does, yeah.
I mean, and it's interesting for me because you know, I've done a few journeys now, bicycled across the U.S. when I was 21, canoed the Mississippi River, bicycled from the Arctic down to San Francisco, and then now this journey canoeing across America is like my Everest in some ways. Like, it's the biggest trip, hardest thing I've ever tried to do.
Well, then you have to do something harder next time.
Yeah, but through that, it's like, it's interesting where I meet people who have done something equivalent, or they've gone on their, like, some big quest or journey, and I can immediately see it. It's like I feel like the kindred spirit energy, like they get it.
Yeah,
you know, they've taken that leap, and you're right. Like, there's more journeys to be had, but just having those doors open, you know, each journey like opens up a new door. Mm-hmm. Of just realizing new depths of who you are and how you're able to connect with the world and connect with other people. Like, that's something that is constantly blowing my mind, is just how abundant the world really is if you're open to it, if you're willing to connect and open up to people in a genuine way, just how, like,
yeah,
that's reciprocated and in ways you would never have expected. You know, in moments where it's almost like the universe and people are there for you in ways that you couldn't have predicted. And it kind of makes me, it definitely makes me feel like there's some greater forces at work sometimes when you really need help. And then all of a sudden it's like the universe conspires to be there for you, you know, where people just somehow have that sense and they're there.
Right. And you also put yourself in a position to, whether it's getting help or making a goal for yourself, you put yourself in the position to get that done too.
Like when you have that greater goal, then
yes,
you kind of are navigating in a way that opens you to, see, opens you to those opportunities that are going to help you get there.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so what are any last thoughts? It's something I always ask people at the end of my show, and I did ask you this before on the river, but if you had 1 year left to live, what is it that you would do and why?
I would try to spend more time with my kids and my family. And live, you know. Probably not too much different than what I'm doing now. I wouldn't do anything drastic. I just try to appreciate every moment of my last year.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Well, it's interesting how, to me, that answer shows that you are living a life already that you love to a large extent.
Yeah, I am. I finally retired. I'm living in the middle of Montana. You know, I couldn't pick a better place to live as far as doing the stuff I like to do. Wouldn't be for everybody, but I'm at the age now where I'm not going to change the world. I'm not going to, you know, I'd like, maybe if I had a year left, I'd like to go visit a few places that I haven't been. But other than that, I would just savor every moment that I got, which I'm trying to do right now because I'm 65. I might not make it another year, or I could make it 30 years. Who knows?
Yeah, that's interesting. And what is the biggest difference between 65-year-old Jim and 20-year-old Jim?
Oh, 65-year-old Jim doesn't move like 20-year-old Jim. My mind still thinks I can do it. The body sometimes says otherwise.
Well, you're pretty damn good shape for 65, well, I must say.
Well, for 65, my knees are gone. I can't hike like I used to. In my mind, I can. But, you know, it's just, I'm probably mellower than I was.
Yeah.
You know, just because I think everybody is. It's kind of really, well, just goes with the territory.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you've grown since then that you really appreciate now, you know, that maybe you didn't know then?
Oh, I don't know. I try to be nicer to people, you know, just because I realize everybody's an individual, whether they're, whatever their lifestyle, whatever their social status, we're all individuals and we're all human. And I try to see what they see, you know, instead of like, oh, there's nothing like me. Why should we be friends? But, you know, when you get to talk to people, that you realize, well, what we are alike. We are kind of the same. So
yeah, like we're all different, but we all can relate to one another.
Yeah.
There's a lot of commonality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you so much for talking with me. You're
My pleasure.
I'm just so grateful to be able to spend time with you guys, and it's special that I'm be able to do that while I'm transitioning into this next stage of my journey.
The easy part's coming up.
Yeah, the downstream section.
Yes.
And hopefully, you know, you'll be able to join me and we'll be able to paddle some more of this river. Yeah.
And might see him peck next summer.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for joining me for today's episode of the Journey to the Heart podcast. For regular updates about my canoe journey across America, my music and other creative projects, be sure to check out my Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube pages at Torlokes and Tornlokes. don't forget the silent H. You can also follow my journey and join my mailing list at www.torrenlokes.com.